We are high, and the dreams that you dream of once in a lullaby. High, oh, somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Dreams that you dream of, dreams really do come true.
You're listening to the best of Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To talk with George Norrie, call the wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Scanning the emails, I just got an email from my cousin Wayne, who lives out near Boston in the Leominster area. Let me tell you, he's a couple years younger than I am, but boy, did we have fun as kids. I'd go out to Boston every summer, where that's where my mother was born. And I got to tell you, we would do things, science things, all kinds. He had a shortwave radio setup that was unbelievable. He had an antenna that must have been 300 feet long, but it was a wire. It wasn't a tall tower thing. And he would pick up things from everywhere. I think I started learning my languages just by listening to that shortwave radio. Well, that's something. It just tells you. You sometimes long for your childhood, don't you? The After Dark newsletter is something that I bet you long for as well, don't you? A couple ways you can order it. You get one a month. One way is on the phone, 1-888-727-5505. The other way is right off the coasttocoastam.com website. Safe and secure. Order it whenever you want. And, yes, you still get a free CD, one of Art Bell's earlier interviews with the late father, Malachi Martin. Eugene Malov, my guest. I'm George Norton. Of course, this is Coast to Coast AM. Eugene, before we go to the calls and later this hour, I want you to kind of relay the incredible story of Joseph Popp and his engine. But very briefly, environmental energy, what is that?
Well, there's something called the second law of thermodynamics, which says that you cannot extract from a uniform temperature reservoir energy. You know that air molecules are zipping by and there's plenty of energy
sure.
in the air. But the second law of thermodynamics says if you have this uniform temperature and you don't have a lower temperature to exhaust the lower energy of a heat engine, you can't run a heat engine in a room that is just one temperature. All right? And so that prevents us from using just the ordinary energy within air, let's say, or water, or anything. Now, the second law of thermodynamics is thought of as an inviolable barrier to using environmental energy. Nikola Tesla thought otherwise, and in 1900 he wrote an essay, and we republished it and commented on it, where he said, he thought he could do it, and many people since then have thought they could do it and failed. Interestingly, there have become large conferences in mainstream physics, no less. There was one in La Jolla in 2002, summer, on loopholes in the second law. And it turns out that there are many loopholes in that law, not the least of which, of course, comes from ether energy, which is a gross violation of the second law. But let's say you don't even believe in an ether. All you believe in is that air molecules and vibrating and moving, can have their energy extracted and make work by some means that has not been thought of before? And the answer, it seems to be that there are many such ways of approaching it, and I do believe that within the next 5 years or so, something like that, for this form of environmental energy, one or more devices based on this principle of taking environmental heat and turning it directly into work, a complete gross violation of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, will be done.
Now, are these three categories an evolutionary stage, or can we just go to the best one and try to work on that?
Well, I think all three should be pursued.
Okay.
That's what we're doing. We certainly cover, in Infinite Energy magazine, we cover all three.
And I guess any one of them would be better than what we have right
now.
Oh,
of course. It would be free energy. In all cases, it would be free energy. I will draw an analogy for your listeners with a computer revolution, a personal computer revolution. At one time, certainly when I was doing my doctoral work at Harvard, we had to pay for the amount of CPU minutes or hours logged in the processing Fortran programs. Well, you give them the card deck, and of course the mainframe computer would click away, and a certain amount of CPU time would click away, and you'd pay for it. Your research budget would pay for it. Now we have things sitting on our desks that are constantly computing, even with a screensaver, say, or some other problem, or database, or any other kind of computer operation, and you're not paying for the CPU minutes that your Pentium or your PowerBook PC is on. You are paying for the electricity, but the paradigm of infinite computation in which you do not pay for computer minutes is there. The same thing is going to happen with energy. That's the ultimate paradigm shift, that there will be no continuing charge for energy. You will ultimately pay, of course, for the device.
Right.
You know, for the unit that you put in your house, whether it's with low energy nuclear reactions, ether energy, environmental energy, whatever it is, or the new solar energy, as we would say, caused by the ether. Okay?
But you never have to worry about going and not having your energy available.
Right. It will be infinite energy, literally, which is why our magazine is appropriately titled. The establishment mocks that title, infinite energy, but that's what energy is. It's infinite, and it should be free, and it is free. Life is free in some sense. Life takes from the environment things that it needs, air and water, and it turns out ether energy as well, and that's how life exists and how life started, okay? Life will eventually return to a system of governance on this planet and elsewhere in the universe that does not depend on constant paying some authority for energy. That era will come. It can't come soon enough, needless to say. And obviously, your listeners have great imaginations. It doesn't take a genius to realize that the world will be turned completely upside down when this era arrives. I do not believe it is the evil oil companies holding this back. That is not, in my opinion, what is happening. What is absolutely happening, though, is academic stupidity, the academic government complex that started the mythology that only one theory can be correct, quantum mechanics is the only thing that can be correct, relativity is the only thing that can be correct, and just as the MIT professor, may he not rest in peace, Hermann Feschbach, who said, I have 50 years of experience in nuclear physics, and I know what's possible and what's impossible. That is the standard stance that is in the way of progress, and it prevents, for example, venture capitalists from looking objectively at experiments. They just go to someone else after you tell them, okay, low-energy nuclear reactions is correct. They go to their favorite physicist, and the favorite physicist says, oh, I know this is impossible. And, of course, since he has PhDs and is with MIT or Caltech or some other place, he's believed, and the outsiders are not believed.
And the funding
that's the
stops.
Essence of it. And that's why, my good friends, we need, for New Energy Foundation and for many other people, we need the research funds. That's the choke point. You cannot expect this work to go ahead for free. It won't happen. It just will not happen. And I know the New Age people and the groupies of many of your other wonderful programs may think that this is just going to happen by osmosis, and the reason it's not happening is because there must be something wrong with the theories and the experiments. Not true. There is nothing wrong with the theories and the experiments, but there is everything wrong with the fact that there isn't enough money in this field, and the New Energy Foundation hopes to change that.
It's too bad the Department of Energy doesn't just fund all this. Let's go to the phones. You ready?
Right.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you for the most important science program in the history of Coast to Coast AM tonight.
Wow. what a promotion that is.
Absolutely wonderful. This man is by far the most articulate to appear on this program in this area of new energy. I don't fault any of the others that have gone before him for their sincerity, and obviously they are also very brilliant men. But Dr. Malov really talks the language of a man who can drive this thing into reality. And
just add money and Malov, and it'll be done. Sorry
well,
for that joke.
My background is fundraising.
Okay.
And I've been thinking about this problem for a long time. I've mentioned it a couple of times when I've called in. Tonight I have an idea. I think there's really only one way to do this. I think of Harry Braun. I think of Mike Brown. I think of Stan Abrams with his turning tires to tomatoes inventions.
Mm-hmm.
I think of so many others, wonderful men, Dr. Stephen Greer, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's fractured. It's fragmented the way you're going about this. There has to be cohesion. We have to put the physics to work in the marketing of this.
Well, of course we do, but the problem, my good friend, and I deeply appreciate your very kind remarks about me and the other people. You know, we may use vacuum energy, but we can't operate in a vacuum. I mean, we have on our staff at New Energy 2.5 people. We used to have more when we had a benefactor who was a bit more generous. We cannot rely, as we are doing now, on only one or two individuals. We have recently gotten 100 or more individual contributors. You know, we're just starting out as the New Energy Foundation, remember. The field needs support. I mean, we gave $35,000 recently. Our entire budget is $250,000 a year. And this includes salaries, okay, for people. This is absolutely crazy to publish an international magazine under the conditions that we do, okay? We're happy that we exist at all. That's number one. Our magazine is $29.95 a year, and if you know, if anyone in the U.S. and if abroad, it's $49.95. So one very minimal thing that people can do is, of course, subscribe either on the website or elsewhere. But we need research funds for these people. I mean, the Correas need money. Cold fusion researchers need money. Dr. Mitchell Swartz needs money. I don't think, Michael, that it is essential for New Energy Foundation to necessarily go out and make firm links, that is, program links necessarily, to lots of other organizations. I think we can play a major role, and I hope others will play a major role too. We're not restrictive. We hope that everyone succeeds. But I must tell you, there's a lot of error going on. There's a lot of spinning of wheels that could be short-circuited by giving the money to the right people. I think a lot of money has been spent, and I know that's true in coal fusion. A huge amount of money has been spent, nothing compared to the money wasted in hot fusion, of course, and many other government programs. But not enough money is being spent on the critical experiments that need to be done. Example one. A Professor Oriani, University of Minnesota, critical work reported at the 10th International Conference last August, okay, in Cambridge. We gave him $5,000. Fortunately, he's emeritus professor. he could have done it almost without the $5,000. But we gave him $5,000 to continue his excellent work on a new aspect of cold fusion that the cold fusion people aren't even looking at. And yet, if his research is correct, it will entirely change the perception of even the mainstream cold fusion. So I'm telling you, we don't need a shotgun. We need a very targeted rifle.
Thanks for that call, Michael. You would think one of the oil companies would say, let's set up a division as an alternative fuel source. We'll make money on it, and let's fund it.
Why that almost, George, that almost happened, and it's a historical record, and we commented upon that in our magazine. Amoco, in the early days after the Pons and Fleischmann announcement, made experiments. They used some of their calorimeters that they were using in some fashion to do oil prospecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they immediately converted them to testing out the Pons-Fleischmann experiment, and they got positive results. And these positive results were driving the administration of Amoco at that time, in the spring of 1989, in the direction of getting into a big way. In fact, the scientist in charge of this reported several years later that they were ready to go with a team of maybe 150 people to get on this ASAP. But when the Department of Energy report came out in November of 1989, only 6 months or so after the announcement, and basically said, we can't find anything, what a crock that was.
So it
turned off Amoco, okay?
Yeah.
It turned off research groups all over the world. In fact, the Indians at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center were going nuts over it. But as soon as they heard that the Department of Energy in the great United States said that this was nonsense, they got scared as well.
Killed the project.
Killed it.
Let's go. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Travis, and I'm calling from AM 600 in Memphis.
Sure. Hi, Travis.
It's nice to talk to you. I have a question that relates to Nikola Tesla.
Sure, sure, go ahead.
When he was doing his Wardenclyffe project, mm-hmm. he was supposedly setting, as the way it was described to me, and like I believe Terry Vassalatos wrote the book.
Yes.
He stated that he was trying to create a huge stream of ether
mm-hmm.
and create that as a wave of energy that would set the Earth into a certain kind of resonance.
Right.
When he would try to set that resonance, you could take another coil of some type and receive that energy mm-hmm. from that location, but it was ripped out from underneath him by, I believe it was J.P. Morgan.
Right. Well, listen, Tesla, there's no doubt that Tesla was one of the greatest scientists of all times. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Obviously, he gave us alternating current and so forth, and radio, although Marconi gets, unfortunately,
and
credit.
And about 700 other things, I guess.
Right. But Tesla was on the right track as far as the ether goes. He was right on track. And the combination, I will tell you this, the combination of what Tesla did with Tesla coils and other things and what Reich did later, the modern Teslas, namely Dr. Paulo and Alexander Correa, using that work and respectfully citing it, very precisely citing it, and writing this up in monographs that can be downloaded from their etherometry.com website, they have formed what you might call a very precise theory of the ether. It's not just hand-waving. It's equations, it's experiments above all, and it is the legacy that Tesla left us. Someday, Tesla and Reich will be looked upon as some of the most important scientists of all time, whereas right today, of course, they are poo-pooed completely
mm-hmm.
by the establishment.
It's only programs like this that give them any kind of recognition.
That's correct. They were brilliant scientists, and I must say that my own prejudices, which were unfounded, and I should be ashamed of myself, for not having gotten into investigating what Reich himself said much earlier. It shows how prejudice pervaded by the establishment has its effect.
It affects even you, Eugene. Stay with us. We'll be back with you and more phone calls. Just a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Would you pay 15 cents to hear this show in its entirety? That's the daily charge for StreamLink. Sign up at www.coasttocoastam.com. Encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. To talk with George Norrie, call the wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Indeed it is, and we're going to continue with your phone calls with my guest, of course, Dr. Eugene Malov, quite a person. Chat with him about some stories as well. You know, the After Dark newsletter, it's available to you, and you can take advantage of it by calling this number, 1-888-727-5505, coasttocoastam.com, and get a free CD, one of Art Bell's earlier interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. Dr. Mello, let's take some more calls, and then maybe toward the end of the show, you can tell us a little bit about the Joseph Popp Noble Gas Engine.
Yes, I will.
Let us go. Who's been waiting so long? Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, George. Dr. Mello.
Yes, sir.
I have two quick questions for you. Number one, if the United States federal government is aware of this coal fusion energy, why haven't they applied it to our usable standings now?
Our what standings?
Usable standings, such as in automobiles, houses, and that type of stuff.
Well, the United States government employs scientists within its structure, and employs, employs university scientists, all of whom are on record, quite publicly so, calling this utter nonsense. In other words, their opinion was formed very early on that the claims and the statements by Drs. Pons and Fleischmann and those who confirmed their work afterwards were fallacious. Okay, they went on record. I mean, one, a hot fusion researcher by the name of Dr. William Happer, still at Princeton, I believe, he told one journalist who wrote a very negative book against cold fusion, he said, just by looking at Fleischmann and Pons on television, you could tell they were incompetent boobs. Now, when you have that person on the panel that was supposedly giving an objective review, then you know that he doesn't, to his core, believe it. He does not, probably to this day.
What about UFOs? Do you believe that UFOs will possibly use some type of ether energy, seeing the fact that its ratio for speed is such as that?
Right. If UFOs are real extraterrestrial spacecraft, and I'm not saying they are, they may well be for all I know, I think there's a strong possibility of that. I do believe that they would have to employ the physics of the universe, which is based, as far as I'm concerned, based on all the things I know today, on the ether, the energetic ether. And one could move through this ether at extremely high speeds. One could obviously tap infinite amounts of energy. Listen, if today devices on Earth that I've told about and that are on our website and in our magazines, our journals, that can do these things right now, that is, tap ether energy, not hydrogen energy per se, but ether energy right now. If we can do that now in a laboratory, then extraterrestrials that are many centuries, millennia ahead of us obviously have mastered this completely, and it would not surprise me at all that they are using that in their craft. And by the way, anti-gravity is another manifestation of the ether. It is a very provocative topic, but I can assure you that I have been witness to anti-gravitational effects demonstrated in the laboratory that have reduced the mass of small objects that are made of one material, gold, namely, by at least 70%.
Wow.
They've gone higher. They've gone to 95%.
I believe Boeing is working on some anti-gravity.
Unfortunately, the work they're doing is being done in a rather half-baked way. There are many claims of anti-gravity today, but if it's done improperly or not based on the right kind of theoretical models, you will have very poor results.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. This is Chris in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
All right. My question for Dr. Malath is, well, there's a couple things, really. You mentioned the Wilhelm Reich experiment with the thermometers.
Yes, indeed.
A friend of mine and I actually did that in 1990. We found a book in our college library that described how to do it.
How'd you do it?
Well, we built basically it's a 1-foot by 1-foot Oregon accumulator.
Yeah.
And once we realized it was actually working, we didn't have a Stirling engine, so we used this thing my mom had. It was a Christmas decoration. You light some candles, and the heat causes this little thing to spin.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah.
It's on like a needle or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we put it on top of it, put a glass container around it, and made sure it got no heat from below and everything. It actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we did it was we were curious about the comment Einstein had made. When he looked inside one, he said, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Well, there was a lot of correspondence, which the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine, sells. It's a 100-page book of the actual copies of the letters, typewritten letters, back and forth between Reich and Einstein, or should I say Einstein and his associates, because he didn't have anything further directly to say to Reich afterwards, other than basically, go away, in so many words. But it's a shameful episode in the history of science, and unfortunately, Einstein, who died in 1955, 2 years before Reich died, could have opened the world's eyes to this true ether and created ultimately perhaps the beginnings of a unified field theory, but he missed the boat because he was not interested in pursuing the experiment, much as the physicists today say of cold fusion, oh, yes, your thermometer is in the wrong place, and this is, you're not doing the bookkeeping correctly, and you must be making mistakes, and because you look like incompetent boobs on television, I'm not going to even investigate your experiments. I mean, the arrogance of the physics establishment is mind-boggling. And I must make another comment here, because I didn't address this at all. Human health is at stake, too, not just human welfare about the environment and our national energy policy and so forth. It turns out that the ether is part and parcel of life.
I believe
absolutely that. Part of life, and all forms of alternative medicine that work, not all forms do, healing touch, above all acupuncture, which is absolutely proved to be a real stimulus that travels from one part of the body to the other, they cannot be explained at all by conventional anatomy or conventional physics. The speed of transmission of the acupuncture signal, as done by a group at UC Irvine and in Japan and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States in 1998, okay, proves unequivocally that acupuncture is a real physical system within the human body. Unfortunately, our mainstream publications like Science and Nature chose to refuse publication of that exemplary work, and it had to be published instead in the much more obscure Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So the ether is part of life and will completely change medicine as well as energy.
Hey, you did a little bit of Hollywood, didn't you? A couple years ago? Weren't you a consultant?
Oh, yes, I was a consultant to the technical consultant to the film
The Saint,
Which used a, did not write the script, of course, but Elizabeth Shue, Val Kilmer, had a nice program and a movie, and dealt with cold fusion as the theme. And honestly, some of the wonderful words that Elizabeth Shue uttered were written by yours truly.
Excellent. I like that movie.
It was good. I like Elizabeth Shue, of course.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
George, how's it going?
Good.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, guest, what do you think about dimensional energy?
Well, when we get into the question of, I have a very low opinion, actually, of alternate dimensions.
Uh-huh.
The dimensions of space that we have and time are quite enough for me. Actually, there's no such thing, in my opinion, as space-time.
Okay. Well,
and so, therefore, I don't believe in 5th, 6th, 7th, and 26th dimensions, which is the rage today with string theory and all this other gobbledygook of the physics establishment. I'll believe in extra dimensions if they can relate it to the experimental evidence of Tesla, Reich, the Correas, and cold fusion.
Okay, well, what I basically meant by that statement was, you know, when you look up in the horizon, that's one dimension. A piece of paper is two dimensions, you know, three dimensions and four dimensions, so on. Well, everything has dimensions. You know, we have dimensions, molecules have dimensions. And I mean, our galaxy, our solar system is just one giant molecule. You know,
no, I don't think our galaxy is a molecule.
Well, you know, not necessarily. I mean, you know, it can be related to.
Now, there are different sizes of things, of course, and there are different scales in the universe. But when we go down into the microcosm, we find different things and different realities than the larger structure of the universe. They're not just similar, okay? There, you can make analogies between, let's say, one thing like a solar system and something else, but that's dangerous to do. Everything starts from measurements that we make on Earth in experiments, and that's what we call Science 101. Measurements are primary. Theories about the measurements are secondary.
We have a few moments left. I want to take some more calls before we're off, but give us a quick synopsis of the Joseph Papp gas engine, the Noble gas engine, spelled P-A-P-P.
One of the most fascinating stories in the history of new energy. Joseph Papp was a Hungarian who came to Canada first, and then he made his way to the United States. He was a rather eccentric man, but he made an engine using an actual gasoline engine that was retrofit. No gasoline system was used in it. No cooling system was used. He claimed that he was using noble gases, that is the gases neon, krypton, xenon, helium, and so forth, and that he made mixtures of it and treated them specially and put them in the engine and made the engine work. Now, the interesting thing about this is the engine was demonstrated on November 18th, 1968, in Gardena, California, at the company Environetics that was then helping him. And Nobel laureate from Caltech, Richard Feynman, a wonderful physicist, but then very skeptical of this. He knew in advance, so to speak, according to a story he wrote later, that Pabst's engine had to be garbage. Okay, it must have been fraud.
So he was another debunker.
He was a debunker. So he came to the meeting, and we have told this in elaborate, excruciating detail in issue 51 of our magazine, which I urge those who are curious to read in subsequent coverage. But in essence, he interfered with the demonstration of the working engine. There were about 35 to 70 people present, and the engine exploded. Okay, Feynman yelled out, "This is a goddamn hoax." That is before the explosion. Interfered with the control system, evidently. The engine did explode. Later, Feynman suggested that the reason it exploded and killed one person, by the way, okay, a person, an engineer from the Mattel Toy Corporation, severely injured two other people and, you know, caused a great stir, was headline news and so forth for a while. Feynman later said that he thought that Papp had blown up his own engine with surreptitious explosives within the engine, okay, to prevent it from being tested. Okay, this was his theory. Now, here's the problem with that theory. Later on, there was a lawsuit, and insurance companies were involved, and Caltech settled with this company, Environetics, that was helping Papp. Now, if there was evidence of real explosives that any panel had found, okay, in the investigation, would Caltech have given one red cent to anybody? Would
no.
the insurance company
no.
have?
No.
So there are two possibilities here. Either the explosion was real from an anomalous physics phenomena, which I personally believe it was, okay, or some agency in that time of 1968 was completely incompetent in investigating a situation and not determining whether or not there was dynamite or not nitroglycerin in that device. Subsequently, by the way, other people more recently have examined and tried to resurrect the PAP process and have actually succeeded in making explosions in noble gases. Noble gases, as many people listening know who know basic chemistry, are not supposed to react in any significant way. There are some reactions they undergo, but certainly you're not supposed to put electricity into noble gases and get a huge amount of extra power.
Exactly. And no exhaust came from this, apparently.
No exhaust, and the engine ran fairly
cool.
It was tested with an independent dynamometer test and was shown to run at 100 horsepower. Indeed, Papp was a very paranoid man, and he did, you know, unfortunately, take the precise mixing details and so forth and processing details to the grave with him. But the good news is that excellent scientists who have their heads screwed on are now in the process of resurrecting it. There's a good chance that it will be resurrected, in which case it would be a wonderful, possibly very dangerous, though, technology. It must be investigated.
I hate to be in a car, though, and have that engine blow up on you.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, about 3 weeks or so before that a terrible tragedy in Gardena, they went out to the desert with a cannon, okay, which is part of it's described in one of the three patents. This cannon was particularly, I call it a cannon, it was a very thick-walled steel tube, and naval personnel from the local area, working with a TRW engineer who's still alive today, who knows a lot about this, sealed that tube so that Papp could not adulterate it with any secret explosives, okay? They took it into the desert, Papp injected it with his gases, and then he attached electricity to it, to the filaments and what have you, and it detonated with a horrendous explosion, blowing up the concrete that was surrounding it and making the steel look like a tulip afterwards. And by the way, just in the last couple of weeks, we received from a party that shall remain nameless, but in any event, we received a DVD which had the tape of that explosion, not the Gardena explosion,
mm-hmm.
the kill,
right,
but
right.
the one in the desert, and we are now going to distribute it all over the world for $15, and anyone who wants to see it can see the 9.5-minute stretch where Papp is putting the gas into the U.S. Navy sealed chamber, and then the thing blows up. Of course, no DVD will ever prove anything.
No.
Clearly.
No.
But this definitely shows Papp. We know what he looked like. It shows him putting the gases in from flasks. It shows the consequences. And we believe that as long as there were no illicit explosives put in there, which seems to be the case due to the Navy precautions, clearly the process was quite anomalous.
All right. We are out of time. Eugene, I wanted to get that story in because it's a fascinating story.
Thank you.
Your website, of course, infinite-energy.com. And the magazine is how much again?
It's $29.95 for six issues a year, or $49.95 if you're other than in North America.
All right. You do let us know if anybody develops anything, won't you?
Absolutely. Just watch our website.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, George.
This has been a special tribute to the life of Dr. Eugene Mallove, who died tragically a week ago. I'm George Norrie. Thank you for listening to Coast to Coast AM.